Next thing I notice is that this blackboard is not for shortage. So past the scammers, let me just put some references to begin with. I can say that a good place to start is the original paper by Hayden Preske. This is from 07, I think. And there is a paper by Susskind and Sekina. There's another paper by Susskind last year. Then I wrote some papers with my student Javier Magán last year and this year. There is Nima Lashkari and collaborators, I think, end of last year. We will cover that part more explicitly. And there's surely more, but let's leave it here. The first thing you notice is that, although you may think that this is an interesting question, the literature didn't grow up so large since our term. So that could be because it's a very confusing subject. It's the case, I think. But it means that reading our a finite amount of papers, you can get to the nature. You can feel confused as anybody. Very soon. So, what is the fastest scrambler? I will. Lots of the confusions have to do with the fact that there are possibly different notions of the of scrambling and of speed. How fast is fast, and what it means scrambling. So I will be very cavalier in my wording because I'm giving the first talk and I will leave to Nima the more detailed issues about how to define scrambling, things like that. Also because I will start sort of from a historical perspective. So I will regard scrambling as somehow global thermalization. So thermalization of the whole size of the system. Okay. So that means that you define the scrambling time, it will depend on the scale in which you are scrambling, on the length scale of the scale. And I will define a fast scrambler, a system that mixes information on a length scale of order L, logarithmically with L. So the time scale like some time scale beta, log L over some other length scale L. So beta and little L are characteristic scales of the system or the state of the voice problem. These are characteristic dynamical length scales.
I'm sorry, I'm already confused. For light to travel across the system takes a time of order L.
Yeah.
So you're saying the scrambling is faster than that?
I'll come to that. Let's put it that way. I didn't tell you how large is L, how big it's a fast scrambler. So this is my operational definition of what a fast scrambler is. Okay?
This is an open system or closed system?
It's a finite system.
Quantum system, so I can find the quantum state?
As a finite system, so it's L.
And so in this sense, what does it mean, thermalization? What is your operational definition of thermalization?
It means that if I start with some state that localizes some information in some region of a space, and the Hamiltonian evolution takes it to a state which is where this information is delocalized. So the physical picture, and this takes me to the next point, the physical intuitive paradigm for scrambling is diffusion. Okay? So,
you could probably define it as action of a random unitary, for example.
Yeah, I could also do that. that will be closer probably to what Nima will talk about. But that is too sophisticated for what I'm going to tell right now. Okay. So let's suppose that you have a system which is local, has local interactions, and I define some, I have some conserved density in the system. Okay. And this conserved density undergoes in general transport. And there are two types of transport in general. One is flow and the other is diffusion. I will regard the scrambling as the diffusive part of the transport. Okay? So that means that you picture, if you want a microscopic picture of it, you imagine that you realize this conserved charge as a bunch of conserved number of quasi-particles, and then what you have is a random walk picture for these quasi-particles. So you have a kinetic model for the picture. So the kinetic picture is random walks. You can do it classically, you can try to do it quantum mechanically, like for example in a sort of Caldera legend type of model. But the idea is that you have some sort of probe in the system on which you store the information and you let the dynamics of the system randomize some basis of states of this probe, which in order to be described by a classical random walk should be a basis which is sufficiently decoherent by interactions. Okay? So it has a nice classical approximation with some, say, coarse grain in time for the steps of the random walk. And you say that the density in which you store, in the structure of the density, you store information. Like, for example, you write the name of your name on the system. Okay? And then you let the name just diffuse away. Okay? The information is stored in the profile of the density. So the physical process, which is obvious, is diffusion. When you have such a system, such a process, the scrambling times on length L go like the diffusion coefficient minus 1 times L squared, like any random walk. Okay. Now, if all the parameters in the system, dimensionless parameters, are of order 1, say for example the velocity of each free glide of random walk is of order 1, then this diffusion coefficient goes like the mean free time in order of magnitude times factors of velocity, coupling constants, whatever, but I will just say that I will simplify my life, and in order of magnitude, I'm just interested in the fact that this thing stays like that. Okay? Now, if this system has order 1 degrees of freedom per beta volume, then I can rewrite this in terms of the number of degrees of freedom of the whole system. The volume of our system. So the diffusion, sorry, I will call this diffusion time. The diffusion time on length L goes like beta times the entropy to over T. So this is the spatial dimension of the system. Okay? Understanding that the entropy is order 1 per unit beta volume. So you can see that this goes like a power light of the length of the system, or the volume of the system, and it's, of course, a longer time than this. It's very fast. Okay? Now, obviously, I come to your question. If I make the system too big, there's no way I can realize such a law with a local system, with local interactions. Because I don't hope to scramble, at least on this method, faster than the speed of sound. Okay? So that means that if I take seriously this idea that the scrambler should be local, then it has to be small. Okay? Or in other words, if the dynamics is local on some length scale, it will be non-local on some small length scale. Let's say that in this length scale the dynamics is local. Then a scrambling over length scale, which are much larger than this length scale, requires that it cannot go like a log. Okay? It goes like a log while I'm scrambling on short distance. But at some point, I have to go over to this other log. So faster scramblers.
So again, that depends on. Well,
must be kind of small.
beta can depend on alpha or not?
No. I'm taking it to be just an intrinsic dynamic of time scale.
Okay.
It can depend on the gap of your Hamiltonian, or it can depend on the effective temperature of your state. Maybe you have a thermal state. Maybe you have a pure state, but if it's taken from some band of states, some superposition of states with local density.
It's independent of the source, but in the black hole context, you know, the Susskind and all the context, I think the scale is basically L log R, or R log R, the size of
I'll tell you what it's not.
So, was it just a comment that in this case, a log diffusion, I recognize if you have a relativistic particle, for example, in this case, I know it from gravity waves. So if you look at the gravity wave traversing a Lorentz invariant random medium, you get a log. Because what breaks there, to get the L squared, you need to be able to localize the regions, and when you have a Lorentz invariant,
okay, well, maybe that is related to something I'm going to say, but we'll see.
Okay, but so, and the interactions are local.
Okay, so where did this funny law come from in the first place? Okay, in these original papers, there are two kinds of heuristic arguments. One of them is an Alice and Bob type experiment about Alice and Bob falling into a black hole. And since they both die, you could call them Romeo and Juliet, it seems. They die at different times. I will leave Nima the burden of going into Alice and Bob, because whenever there is Alice and Bob in the audience, in the discussion ends there. Questions and we cannot say anything more. So let's postpone Alice and Bob. Let's postpone Alice and Bob until the end. The other source of heuristic arguments to argue for this have to do with the membrane paradigm. Here, the idea is that you have a special action, say, a Planckian distance from the real horizon, and then you have the edge of the real space. So here, horizon, you have a region where it is approximately linear. Yeah? And suppose that you put an electron here. And then it turns out that if this membrane is taken sufficiently near the horizon, everything that goes on about the behavior of the electromagnetic fields in this region can be sort of substituted in an expansion which is the better you approach the membrane to the horizon, by some effective local dynamics on this surface, consisting of a charge density with its corresponding current, which is conserved, and a number of transport coefficients. That is for the electromagnetic fields. If you put gravitons in the game, then you also need to specify a velocity field for a hydrodynamical fluid.
So is this a space diagram, or?
No, this is just a very nice picture of
Is it supposed to be space at one time?
No, this is just a snapshot.
Right.
This is just the most nice thing. So, and the way it works for the case of the electromagnetic sector, which refers in a hypothetical holographic dual to a conserved charge, a conserved global charge, is that this membrane acts like a conductor. So the electric field acquires, the electromagnetic field acquires conducting boundary conditions here. So what happens when you have an electron here? There is an induced charge distribution here, which concentrates positive charge in the region which is closer to the electron, and a little bit of negative charge outside, so the total is zero. Okay. And then when I move this electron into this thing and take it to this region, what happens is that as I move it, this concentration of electric charge of positive charge peaks extremely large, actually becomes peak, like an image electron is building up here. While at the same time, this negative electric charge gets homogeneously distributed on the whole horizon. So when the electron enters this, it annihilates. The electron annihilates with the image electron that is building up here, and the, what remains suddenly is just this uniform distribution of negative charge, which is homogenized. Okay. So now, if you look at the whole thing, suppose that you have, hypothetically, a dual holographic description of this chunk of metric. Okay. So you have your favorite CFT. You can put this in ABS. And you have run the holographic normalization loop up to this radial position, which means that you have taken the Wilsonian cutoff to scales over T. And you have an effective action, an effective free theory action, which is complicated, full of empty traces, whatever. In that theory, the initial state, which is just this localized gauge charge, is a localized global density of charge, a state with localized global charge in the dual theory. It's localized in space-time, it's localized in the metric, in the CFT, and it is also spectrally localized in the ultraviolet, because it's close to the ultraviolet cutoff. This process in which the electron falls ends with a distribution, with a state which is completely smeared over the space degrees of freedom. And the metric of the CFT looks like a uniform thing. And it's concentrated in low energy degrees of freedom. It's concentrated in the states that are near the horizon and therefore very reshifted and very soft. So that is what you would call scrambling, because you have a localized distribution and you make it uniform. How much time it takes? The time it takes is the faster you can do it is the threefold time, or if you like the speed of light time for shooting an electron here. And when you compute that threefold time, you find this here. So for a Schwarzschild black hole, what you find is T to the minus 1 log Rx over the plan. And this is just beta, where beta is the inverse of the Hawking temperature, log the entropy of the black hole. Okay? So, now, having said this, yes.
Excuse me. So this is the calculation in Schwarzschild for the time to drop it from what radius?
From the edge of the inverse region. So for a radius of order T.
Order T. Oh, the Schwarzschild radius or something.
Just the log that appears in the tortoise coordinate.
Okay.
Right.
Yes.
And you have to count until it reaches Planckian distance from the horizon. Now, having said this, you may argue, this doesn't look very much like a scrambling, because after all, this looks like a flow, because it's a very ordered thing. Okay, it's a choreographed, very well choreographed motion of charges. It doesn't look at all like a scrambling. It's not turbulent or anything. Okay? But from the point of view of the hypothetical dual theory, which would replace this whole thing by some free theory dynamics, is doing what you want to do, in a sense to say that you have uniformized this distribution over this region, and in this very long time.
What's the stretch horizon from the point of view of the dual?
The stretch horizon from the point of view of the dual is a phenomenological thing. You cannot really make it very precise, because it's a way of taking into account the fact that you are going to work at finite end. Now, there's no systematic way of doing that unless you really work with the full theory in the dual, well-defined CFT. Okay? This is a little bit, I like to compare it with the Bach model of hadrons. In the Bach model of hadrons, you incorporate the fact that you have asymptotic freedom, but you simulate confinement by saying that you have a Bach. And then you can play around and give properties to the Bach. Make it, write an action for the bag and things like that. And you can get some mileage out of that, but there is nothing very much you can do to improve it systematically. It's a phenomenological model which cannot be systematically improved, because you never know what is the systematic error we have here. By the way, the same happens for any model of hadrons. also a scheduling model, talking for the quad model. The stretch horizon is a little bit like that. It's a way of partitioning degrees of freedom, taking into account the fact that for most of this geometry, the interactions are very weak, because they are suppressed by one over n, due to the Hawking radiation being very quickly coupled to anything here. But somehow, all the states should pile up with finite density near the horizon. You cannot, if you allow the horizon to be mathematically defined as an infinite phase shift surface, then that is equivalent to working at any chemical thing. That's okay for calculating things in powers of 1 over n, or even to calculate instanton type things in powers of e to the minus n, but to really get finite n effects generically, you need to somehow implement the whole thing. So, with this definition, you can come back to this problem. I can now take a black brain, which is very big, and ask myself, well, what is the answer from this definition, this formal definition, what is the answer for the schrodinger? I should get something which is reasonable. Okay? And you find that if you take a black brain, which is an horizon, which is as big as you want, and you just compute this whole time here, okay, for any your favorite black object that you can build in any holographic type geometry. Okay. What you always find is universal, the answer, it's very nice, for such a threefold time, is beta, the index of the temperature, times the log of the entropy, what I call the specific entropy here, is an effective entropy, which is equal to the total entropy if the system is smaller than the thermal level. Say, for example, a mere stream of Weissenstrom black hole, which has a size which is much smaller than the inverse temperature. So that's a black hole, it's also like that. It has a size of the order of the inverse temperature. So it's going to be if you have a black brain, what you get here is the entropy per thermal cell. So it's the entropy divided by Vt to the D, where V is the volume in CFT units. So in the metric here, in the metric at the cutoff scale here, the volume of the CFT volume, if you like, D is the temperature, D is the spatial dimension, the spatial dimension. So this is, and this, for a typical thermal state of a conformal theory, this is proportional to the central charge. N squared for the HT. So what you get here in the log for that case, for a log system, you get beta times log central charge of the system. Yeah. So you recover the definition, the intuition that the phase of fast scrambling should only take place while you are scrambling in small distances. When you come out of the thermal cell, you should be start scrambling in the usual sense, very huge. So you have now a CFT at the strong coupling in a box which is much bigger than the thermal cell. And I insert, say, some local state that I will monitor how it diffuses in time, which is concentrated on a length scale which is much smaller than beta. It can fast scramble until it reaches order beta, and then among the different thermal cells, it should go to diffusion. Now, you can argue, in fact, you can argue it very explicitly if you just think of this as n equal 4 super Jan Mills and use the dual picture with diffuse brains, that if I take this box adiabatically and concentrate it into size beta, in the bulk, you get this transition, which is related to Gregory Laplan localization of black hole, of the black hole. Okay? And this transition sends you to the theory of D0 brains, which is a nice model. So the physics on scales of the order of the thermal cells is better described with a lattice model. And the idea is that you have sort of a lattice with lattice spacing beta, You have a matrix model in each lattice point. The interactions are local between thermal cells, so the diffusion is normal. But within each thermal cell, the fastest scrambling has to do with large chain effects in matrix model. So it's happening in index stage. It's something that has to do with index stage.
Would you try to
put n equals
4 on torus?
Yeah, you can do that for n equals 4.
If you make it larger than beta, then you have to consider
1 2. No, you have to make it smaller than that.
Torus.
When you do T1, and in the T12, the fiber torus is growing in the T12 metric, you get the stability of the value. Okay, so this is just the realistic path to the idea that in order to study matrix, faster scrambling, like from first principles, you should try to prove that matrix models are faster scrambling. Okay? That's going to be difficult, or at least for me now. So in the rest of the discussion, what I'm going to do is to show, I'm going to make two comments, which I think are illuminating for the discussion, which relate to the fact that maybe we can dig more information about the problem in just with geometry. Okay. But before I come to the geometry, let me just say that you can contemplate systems which are perfectly standard and you know, not very exotic, which are fast scramblers and are just behaving as a normal diffusive system, in the sense that they are completely kinetic. I will give you two examples. One example is Hallam-Arvinian. The Hallam-Arvinian is the first chaotic mechanical system that people sort of define. This is is a billiard on a negative Lyapunov space. So suppose you take a quantized ball, it's just a hyperbolic space, constant curvature, and you carve out of it a bunch of spheres. You can do this in a fancy way by saying that you take the hyperbolic and divide it by some discrete group, just like when you construct the uniformization of spheres. But you can do it in higher dimensions too. So let's say that the radius of curvature is beta, and I carve out the spheres which are also of size beta. So the volume of the billiard, which is what is left behind, is controlled by the number of the spheres that I carve out. Okay? If I want more volume, I have to carve out more spheres. I have to go farther away. Okay? So in this system, you just drop a marble, it's a chaotic system, which achieves scrambling in the sense that you lose control over the position of the marble in a few collisions, so order one collisions. It's maximally chaotic. The time, the Lyapunov time, which is the time for achieving this uniformization, is of the order of the only length scale that you have in the problem, which is the curvature radius, beta, I am assuming the velocity is 1, times the crossing time of the billiard. And the crossing time of the billiard is just the diameter of the billiard. You can write it as the log of the volume of the billiard in units of beta to the end. So here is a system that scrambles logarithmically with its volume. It's nothing fancy, yeah? Just a map. Now suppose another system that does this in a different way is sort of the opposite limit, in which instead of just restricting the interactions to the boundary conditions, I allow my system to interact freely in the bulk, just making a random walk, but still keep the hyperbolic geometry. So what I have is a sort of a lattice, which is a tessellation of a hyperbola. Such a lattice, if it is very symmetric and regular, is called a vector lattice in physics. Okay? The infinite regular tree in mathematics. So it's just a lattice in which you have, for example, all this fixed number, fixed ordination number, and it's a tree. You find out very soon that you cannot draw this thing respecting the metrical relations in a plane. You have to draw it in a hyperbola. In general, expander graphs are graphs that have this expanding property, which means that if you cut out a sphere in this discrete lattice, the area of the sphere measured by the number of links that cross it is of the same order of magnitude up to a number of order one, which depends on the coordination, as the number of vertices contained inside the ball. Okay? Now, it's a classic result in graph theory that random walks in expanded graphs are fast scrambling. So, if you have a random walk with a probability density n after n steps, and you compare it with the uniform probability density, which is 1 over the number of vertices, mm-hmm. you take the norm of this, and you ask it to be bounded by 1 over n vertices to a positive power, this happens for n larger than c, a constant, times log n e. Okay? This is a very simple theorem. In the continuum approximation, if you write the diffusion equation on the hyperbola, it's very easy to see why. It's because if you write the diffusion equation and you write it in polar coordinates, it becomes a focal point equation with a velocity which is a brief term, which is proportional to the inverse tangent, hyperbolic tangent of the radius. And that becomes of order one very soon. So what you have is a distribution which has a kind of a rain structure. And it's growing at almost the speed of light. And here it's broadening just like a normal random walk. It's broadening with a log which is square root of t. But it is just, you know.
This is entropic because there's always more space to this.
Right. So here are two very simple systems that achieve fast scrambling in a deceptively simple way. Yeah? Kind of trivializing the whole thing.
Can you repeat the examples that I gave, which is physical and very simple? In fact, actually, it can be more like you take a photon and you send it through in this case, it would be a random stochastic background of gravity wave. This is the example that I know. And you get a diffusion that goes through some of these.
Okay. So now, to finish, let me just say that there's all these characterizations depend on the idea that I have a probe. Okay? I have a probe in which I monitor the scrambling. I have sort of some kind of quasi-particle. If you want to put it in the black hole context, it has to be very stable also. So you think of some visible brain, for example, it's a good probe for that. You can take it and scatter it with a spectral isotope. But it would be good to have some characterization which doesn't depend on the probe, and this is what Nima will probably show you from first principles method. But let me just say that that is, of course, related to questions of how to parameterize entanglement entropy in the system, how entanglement entropy depends on different partitions of the system. But expander graphs, from the point of view of entanglement entropy, are very fine, because if you take a quantum system in an expanded graph, which is gapped, which means that the correlation functions are short distance, so the only, say, entangled states which are linked which are first neighbors, such a state, which is a grand state of that gapped system, and is not thermal at all. If you compute any bipartition of such a graph and compute entanglement entropy, it will have area law, like any other entanglement entropy for a gap system. But in an expanded graph, area law is parametrically like volume law. So it will also look, unless you are very careful in naming the coefficient up to order one, it will look also like a thermalized density matrix. So the usual criterion of saying that you have thermalized the system when under partitions, the entanglement entropy tracks the thermodynamic entropy, is not such a good idea for expanded graphs. One thing that you can do to characterize the entanglement, I mean, quantum mechanically characterize expanded graphs if you like, the fastest scrambling aspect of scrambling graphs, is to take into account the behavior under correlation functions, the local probes. So if you take, for example, the commutator function for local operators, these operators are bulk operators now. They are put here inside the system. And you compute this thing. Then, for expanded graphs, this thing should be mostly concentrated on the light cone, on the effective line cone in the system. Even if it is the commutator function, which is the retarder is related to the retarder Green function, which should be, in general, this thing has quasi-normal modes. So it has poles of the real axis, and in general, it's not supported on the light cone. And you can actually prove, very simply, that if you take the continuum case and you take a conformality theory, an interacting conformality theory, and consider this object for a temperature which is 2 pi, the range of curvature of the hyperboloid, it is well known that this thermal state on the hyperboloid is conformal to a vacuum state in a portion of Minkowski, actually the inside of the lid ball. So the thermal density matrix is basically the entanglement matrix in Minkowski, tracing out what is outside of the lid ball. But the commutator function for that theory is supported strictly in the light bulb because it's in zero temperature Minkowski. So that means that you have ballistic behavior even at finite temperature and with arbitrary interactions if you nail the temperature to this point. So to finish, let me just mention in 2 minutes the connection of these heuristic considerations to black holes. The connection is just the fact that near the horizon of black hole, I can always write the metric scaling out the V0 factor. In this form, so I can write it now as a conformal transformation of another thing which I call the optical metric. I mean, I don't call it, it's called like that. You can learn about it in many papers by Gary Gibbons recently and also from years ago. This is an intrastatic metric, which means that any thermal state in this metric is homogeneous. Okay? And the thermodynamic functions are extensive. And it turns out that in the near horizon regime, this metric always looks like minus V squared plus V squared plus E of I squared beta, gamma ij PH3. The gamma is a finite scaling of this metric here, the metric on this cut of surface. And this Z is just the total scoring. And the horizon, or if you like the stretch horizon, is sitting at beta log S cell. So this is an expanding geometry of it's asymptotically locally hyperbolic, and it's a piece of a hyperbolic, okay, which is cut off at this moment. So if I guess build a brick wall model of torque, which is just about the dumbest possible stretch horizon model you can imagine, just a reflecting condition. And instead of just a sharp reflecting condition, I put satellites in it, I get the Hallam-Villiers. And I get it right with the right scaling for the volume of the Villiers related to the integral black hole test. If on the other hand, I imagine that the scattering of the probe is very efficient over the whole Grignard space, perhaps because the whole Grignard space is stringy, because my theory in my holographic dual is not strongly coupled, it's not a glass soft coupling, maybe it's a soft coupling for the one. And then the whole thing is kind of strongly coupled, so maybe the interaction with the Hawking radiation is not anymore weak. In that case, I get a model in which I get scattering on a summit graph, and I also get the same scaling on the record of the sun of the sun. So these phenomenological models sort of fit the bill in two limits. Of course, there is not much more we can do about that, because the whole thing of the specialization is kind of a fudge. Okay? But it tells you that if you are going to prove a fast scrambling for a matrix model, and your matrix model is strongly coupled, you should probably try to dig out from the structure of the matrix model something related to classical chaos or quantum chaos, which one can also talk. And if you are going to study fast scrambler for a weakly coupled matrix model, you should try to dig out from the structure of the matrix model the algebraic structure of the Van de Graaff. Okay? So that's the.
So the idea here is that you find a work metric for the near horizon region, which whose slices are hyperbolic spatial curvature.
What?
Is that what you're doing here? Is that a way to say what you're doing?
No, I'm just saying that Ringler is locally conformal to hyperbolic.
Yeah. So you want to think of the dual as living on this hyperbolic space?
Well, if the physics I'm describing is bulk conformal invariant, then study it in the optical metric.
Sure.
And that is the case for a random walk made of piecewise null paths.
So
a very fast random walk, which is something which is, while it is free gliding, goes as fast as it can go, which is speed of light. So anything that is a diffusion process, either a random walk or a scattering of some boundary condition, which is made of piecewise null paths, is conformally invariant. So I can study it in the optical method. In fact, any dynamics becomes asymptotically conformally invariant as you go near the horizon, only that also relevant operators come down. So at some point, when you get to the stretch horizon, you cannot use the Lorentz effective theory. But in between, before you hit the wall of the relevant operators, all the masses in the theory go down in the optical frame. You can see it as another frame, just like we work with a string frame or Einstein frame. It just depends on the probe. To work in the optical frame, you have to rescale the field. But you can do it. Another thing is that if it is a good idea or not, depending on what you are computing.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
Yeah, so I just, your example one, which was really nice, exhibits a feature I just wanted to, you know, take a minute to explain. Like, that's a very general feature of chaotic dynamical systems, and I think in, like, a few words I can say that. So if we have a chaotic dynamical system, then we expect that there are these Lyapunov exponents, which tell you how little blobs of configurations expand in the phase space. And then if you want to count the number of cells in your phase space that blob is intersecting, and then take the log, that gives you an entropy. And then there are theorems in ergodic theory which tell you that the rate at which that entropy grows is just controlled by the Lyapunov exponents, and that's sort of intuitive. And so if your phase space has finite volume, then eventually you spread out to the entire phase space, and since that entropy growth rate is just linear, it makes sense that the time it takes to fill out that entire phase space is going to be logarithmic in the volume of the phase space. Whenever you have Lyapunov exponents and this kind of evolution takes place, like in your billiard, then
of course there is the question that when you go quantum, this whole thing becomes a transient. And in fact, this is also the Ehrenfest time, which is the time at which the classical phase space picture loses.
Right. So as far as the quantum, I mean,
this just makes it to the Ehrenfest time, and then you go
right
to the quantum noise.
Right. Well, I just want to say, I mean, in thinking about quantum, as you pointed out, it's appropriate to think about entanglement entropy of subsystems with the rest, and one can also show that the growth rate of entanglement entropy in certain circumstances is controlled by the Lyapunov exponents. And so, for example, in thermalization of CFTs after a global quench, which is something that has been studied over the past few years, you can also see a linear growth rate of entanglement entropy for a given subsystem. And so there, again, it's clear that the thermalization time would be logarithmic in the size of the subsystem. And in some circumstances, you can understand that from this dynamical systems perspective as well. That might take us off into another discussion, but yeah.
Okay, I think I should
Can I have a question before you do? Because this is a static situation. How do you conceive it changing if you have, for example, a rotating black hole when you have velocity-dependent forces as well as the free form?
Well, I don't know. If I build these kinetic models, that would correspond to diffusion with a drift.
Right.
I didn't really go into that.
I mean, do the estimates get completely wrong, or just you get some median correction?
I don't know. I suppose that it should still work, but I don't know. It's interesting. In that case, you're not just diffusion. It's not pure diffusion. It's diffusion plus drift.
Yeah, exactly.
So in the L squared case, I can see that you get to some limiting velocity.
Well, there is the following possibility. If you take your little model here by putting in a magnetic field, which is equivalent, if the magnetic field is weak, of course, you don't change the ergodicity, but there's a nice threshold beyond which the magnetic field gets so strong that you do. So in the hyperbolic plane, it's very clear, because if the Landau orbits are really small circles and they're much smaller than the size of your cell, then of course you won't have any chaos.
Ah, yeah, okay.
So there should be some interesting features there, which are often, there's a connection with supersymmetry naturally, but you might expect that only a rotating black hole, perhaps, will give you the chaos, except when it's close to criticality. That's nervous, but there seems to be a richer structure if you consider rotation.
Okay, I have a totally off-the-wall comment, which is one thing that has always struck me as sort of intriguing, sort of coming after this comment about the relation between scramble end times and entanglement entropy times, is that if I just, in this formula you wrote for the scramble end time, replaced that by the entanglement entropy, it's a true fact about conformal field theories. Like, so any two-dimensional conformal field theory has the property that the entanglement entropy is proportional to the log of the length of this region that you're studying. And so, that's just the truth, that's one version of Cardi's formula, okay, for conformal field theories. And so, I've often wondered if there's a general...
People have generalized that to Fermi surfaces, too.
Exactly, yeah. So exactly, I mean, if you imagine that a Fermi surface has effectively was a conformal field theory per bit, per unit volume on the Fermi surface, then you have the similar log LJ behavior. So a totally off-the-wall suspicion that I have is that somehow the fact that the formulas are identical is a lesson that we should internalize in some way. I'm not going to say that we should internalize it or what it means.
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on the particular dynamic. Like I mentioned global quenches, which is where you change the Hamiltonian everywhere at the same time, and then that can give you a time that's like a logarithmic in the size of the subsystem, but I mean that's a very special kind of dynamical situation where everything happens at the same time. If you have, you know, just a lump that you kick it somewhere and then that starts thermalizing, that'll be a different dynamical situation. I would expect a different time scale. That's just a comment to consider.
I think we should.
We should. Let's thank Jose.
I don't know if it works. So.
You don't need to do anything, just give it to him. Yeah, sure.
That was a great introduction and some interesting ideas. Actually, I'll get to this later, but we were at the same time studying the quantum version of this, and I'll tell you what we found. We're sort of confused at the quantum still about that problem. So today all I want to tell you is the stuff you've learned, the lessons, I want to give you a brief summary of the lessons you've learned in the past few years, like 3 or 4 years, by thinking about fast scramblings in language of quantum information theory. And by we, I mean, in addition to myself, Patrick Kagan, Matt Hastings, Tobias Osborne, Douglas Stanford, and of course, Lenny and Steve. All right. So let's start by actually writing down what the conjecture is at the moment and what it looks like, and I'll tell you more about it. Before I start saying that, let me just tell you a few words why we should use quantum information theory, why is it relevant. So when I talk about quantum information theory, a natural thing that probably some of you are asking is that what is quantum information theory and why should it help us? Why is it relevant? So quantum information theory, briefly speaking, is a systematic study of how information is stored, transmitted, and recovered in quantum systems. This is a very short definition for it. So why is it relevant? Well, we can already see a connection between information loss problem or like information loss from black holes or fast scrambling to this. But I have two better, well, personally, I have two other reasons to believe that it's relevant. First one is actually the fact that all the statements or theorems that we're showing quantum information theories are statements that deliver operator algebras in number spaces. So they're completely independent of the nature of what the degree of physical degree of freedom you're talking about. So if you have a powerful theorem, you can just apply it to a wide range of physical systems that are relevant to what you said. So operator algebra theorems or techniques, if you want, if you wish. The second reason that I think, again, this is my personal point of view, but I'd like to share it with you, it's relevant, is that, well, in quantum information theory, we spend an awful amount of time thinking about correlations and information and how it's stored. And in no sense we're talking about, this is a generic statement on Hilbert states, we're not thinking about perturbative Hilbert states or anything. So it provides a natural tool for studying strongly correlated systems where correlations are very strong. All the statements you prove apply in those cases as well. That's why actually probably you've seen condensed matter every day. There are more and more applications of quantum information theory in strongly correlated systems. So it applies to strongly correlated systems. And it's sort of in a sense, well, you may disagree with me, but it's a natural language for talking about correlation in strongly correlated systems. All right, so let's write down what the conjecture is. I will tell you, I'll go over the lessons. Some of them are precise, could be made precise, some of them are vague. You've learned in the past few years about by thinking about fast scrambling. Okay, so what is the statement? The way that Susskind and Sakima formulated it is that fastest scramblers in nature take scrambling time proportional to log of the number of degrees of freedom. And then black holes saturate the sound, black holes take log n. Matrix quantum mechanics takes log n. And then there was a paper I erased last year that appeared that this is again Susskind conjecture that the causal patch of DS and also linear space are fast scramblers. Okay, this is what the conjecture is, but I can tell you what questions we can address so far. How are we going to contribute to understanding this problem? Because we can't really address all of these, for sure. So we can address, so far we've been able to address three of these three different questions. First one is that actually a lot of lessons we've learned is towards we've made an awful amount of work to understand what does scrambling mean. So to make this precise, okay? So what is a precise form of the conjecture? Among other things, the most important thing is what is the definition of scrambling time? I'll use T star just to avoid confusion. Another thing that we did was that we found two examples, particularly simple, relatively simple examples that are quantum fast scramblers. Examples of fast scramblers. In the same line of the examples that previous speaker was saying, same sort of ideas, but probably we have more quantum control. When you're talking the same experiment making are, again, at the level of operator algebra, and they're very precise. So examples of fast scramblers. Let me just name them right now for the moment. First one is the Brownian quantum circuit. The second one is Ising model, let me put it that way, on a random graph. And actually, the third example we're considering was a quantum version of expander graph, where there's a, let's say, spinner sitting at each point here. But the version of the definition that we have so far for scrambling showed that it was not a fast scrambler in quantum sense. But we suspect it's a problem with the definition. Oh, yeah. I'll get to that, actually. That's important. I'll show you examples of systems that, like, two different definitions look like scrambled or they don't.
Are you putting in any condition about locality or?
No, absolutely not. The systems I'm going to study are actually mostly non-local, extremely non-local. They're like Ising models sitting in graphs. So think of it this way. There's a Hilbert space on this node. There's another Hilbert space on this node. For simplicity, this could be a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And then there are interactions. Whatever the interaction between these two Hilbert spaces, I draw a line in between them. So what I get at the end of the day is sort of like a graph. So this is the way we think about these things. They're extremely non-local at first. And actually, ultimately, we would like to address EFSS matrix model for sure is a fast scrambler. We can't show that by yet. We're actually not close to it either. But what we can show is that with certain physical assumptions, matrix model, EFSS matrix model cannot scramble faster than log n. That we can show. But with certain assumptions that are sort of important. I'll talk about that.
So for the base of that, it looks to me as if I would call that local, because if the mates just tell you whether those Hilbert spaces are interacting, that's what we normally think of as a local interaction, not like the one you've drawn there.
No, I understand. It's just the reason we're starting with these models is that to just make the definition of scrambling precise.
Oh, okay.
And this is the simplest thing we think of. Eventually, when we get there, but we're not there yet.
It's non-local when the connectivity degree scales with the size of the system.
Yeah.
It has fixed connectivity for you make the system large, then it's local.
So for example, if you have a graph, for the maximal degree of the graph is a finite number that does not scale with n, you can always embed this on lattice. I can always embed it on lattice, okay? All right. Okay, so let me start with the first part, making the conjecture precise. And I'll tell you, I'll go over lessons that we've learned so far. Some of these are just impression we have. Some of them are exact and precise. Okay. Lesson one, let me just call them this way. Okay, let me tell you first what is the idea behind this. The idea is very physical. So the systems that I'm going to be considering are all closed systems. Okay. So what do we mean by thermalization? What do we mean by scrambling? So it's what we're going to mean is that we know that for time scales that are much smaller than the Poincaré recurrence time, the system
can forget its initial state. So if you start, let's say you have a bunch of spins, and you start with a certain excitation here, up or down, and the other states are independent of this up or down J bit, mm-hmm. after some time, you can't really tell apart subsets of size S for J when was J was or when J was zero. They all look the same. So the system forgets its initial state. Although there is Poincaré recurrence time, and eventually you're going to recover your initial state, but for our purposes, this is sufficient.
That's sort of a basis dependence statement, right?
Yes. This is an important point in that, what I'm going to talk about. It's extremely basis dependent. So we try to make this.
You have in mind, well, you have a natural basis, say, provided by the spin system.
I'll talk about this in detail. Okay, so this is the idea, but what is our practical definition? So by practical definition, I mean a definition that up to few things is what we're gonna follow for the rest of our study. But there are little things that matter. So the definition is this. If you have a state, let me see how can I say it so that it's least confusing. All right. First, construct a subset of Hilbert space, which are the allowed initial states, psi at equals 0. So you're not going to consider all states in the Hilbert space. You're not going to scramble all states in the Hilbert space. You just want to look at certain initial states. You want to restrict yourself to a subset, and you want to scramble among those. Okay?
Do you mean a subset or a subspace?
Sorry? The subspace of the Hilbert. Subset, actually. Subset of
the Hilbert. Is that a finite number or discrete number?
We consider both of them. We consider subsets for the finite numbers, and we consider subsets. Actually, there are examples.
Discrete, right? It's not. You're not taking linear combinations of states.
I'll mention that. Linear is. I'll mention that. Let me just. If you can say linear combination, you're scrambling a system that is. If you take your set of allowed states to be initial states that are orthogonal to each other, you get a scrambling time. But the scrambling time that you get if you allow all their superpositions is always larger than this. So it takes always more time if you allow arbitrary superpositions. This we can show. Okay. Yeah, but I'll actually expand on that. All right, so what is our practical definition? The definition is that pick two arbitrary states from your set of allowed states. So call them psi 0 and phi 0. Let them evolve. After some time t star, you have psi t star and phi t star. If trace over arbitrary subsystems, they all look the same, you have scrambled that subset of your allowed states. So you picking two arbitrary systems among your allowed states is your initial information, and by making them all look alike, look like each other, you have forgotten about that. You have lost that. You have scrambled that information. This is important to actually understand, because I'm going to be using this over and over again.
So what does equals mean?
This is one of the important things. So let me just brief. Thank you, trace norm. That's a brief answer, but
you said arbitrary subsystems.
Arbitrary subsystems. Arbitrary allowed states from the set.
These are traced over. These are arbitrary subsystems.
He's tracing over S. What does it mean? Yeah.
Oh, arbitrary subsystems. Yeah. Okay. So subsystems of size and yes. Yeah. Of course, you can't. Otherwise, you can't. But my definition can't scramble.
And if I tracing over the systems of size zero, is it non-trivial operation?
No, it's not. Of course, but that's why it's good. Not necessarily, but I'm going to prove a theorem about that, actually. Well, this is,
what do you mean by psi sub s is the density matrix where you trace over everything outside the system?
So psi s is trace s complement of psi t Sorry, I should have clarified. This is in standard notation convention. I should have said that. Sorry, I apologize. Okay, good. So this is a practical definition, but I have to say probably immediately a few things that I just lied about. But to be honest, first of all,
the definition for any pair of states, and you are not requiring this equality to approximate the thermal answer, or this is a consequence of
these two should be close to each other. Meaning that I should not be able to have observables that tell these two states apart. Because if I tell them apart, I have recovered my initial encoded bit up or down.
Let me correct myself. This is controlled by the norms that you are going to introduce?
Exactly. Oh, this is one of my points.
Okay.
So if you use a trace norm, if the trace norm is small, it implies the interpretation of that quantum information is that if you try to tell them apart, you will fail with the probability of 1 minus epsilon-ish. 1 minus 4 epsilon, I think. I don't remember exactly, but some tiny number.
No matter what observable you use.
No matter what observable you use. That's just a statement about all operators on the Hilbert space. Okay.
It can't be independent of the class of operators, so there must be also a requirement about the operator.
We'll see. Right. This is
one of the... We're talking about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, it's an exact statement. Any operator on the Hilbert space cannot do that. Let me just tell you, I forgot to tell you an assumption I made. But let me just get there and we'll see. I haven't made the statement precise yet. Okay, so it depends. So P star depends, as was mentioned, crucially depends on initial state, or the set of initial states you allow. Okay, so for example, simplest example, if you make a small perturbation that's local, you expect this to scramble fast. Whereas if you have a metastable state, that's going to take forever to scramble, right? This is a simple example, a little bit non-trivial example of what you mentioned. If I pick my set of states to be orthogonal, it's a lot easier to scramble this set rather than a set that includes all the arbitrary superpositions of these states. This is the second example, which is a little bit not trivial, but expected. Okay, so part of the game is going to be finding the right initial set of states that we're going to scramble. Okay. Now let me give you the big picture in advance, just in case you're wondering.
Will you make any assumption about the spectrum in the Hilbert space that you will consider, or you will be as generic as you want? Because if this is, that's the question.
In what particular case?
Well, I guess I'm wondering, if you consider a Hilbert space of some system that may have some holographic dual at high temperatures.
We do not make any assumption
that.
Whatever assumption I make about the Hilbert space, I say it explicitly.
Okay.
If I do not say it explicitly, you should ask, and I might be forgetting something. But there are parts that we understand, mm-hmm. precisely. There are parts that we don't understand. I'll mention what we don't understand. I'll try to be
fair.
Okay, so this is a big picture. Here I mentioned, that this is not precise. What I'm going to say right now is not precise. This is the impression we have by studying different toy models. So here is the size of the set that you picked, your set of initial states. So ideally, you would like to mix as many, to pick this size to be, to this subset to be as large as you. One, right? So here is all states in the Hilbert space. And here, a finite, let me say all states in a particular basis. Okay. And we actually, and over here I'm going to plot randomness. So If you want to be able to scramble as many possible states as you can, you should introduce randomness. The answer is simple. So if you pick your, for example, if you pick your Hamiltonian to do a random walk in space of unitaries, you're going to be able to scramble lots of states. But if you pick a particular Hamiltonian, of course you're not going to be able to scramble eigenstates of that Hamiltonian. Right? That's very intuitive. But so this is big picture, but there are some, this, we can't prove anything rigorous about this.
I'm sorry, I'm really confused by what that means. Are you going to have a quantum system that has a definite Hamiltonian or not?
We're going to look at both of them. Quantum systems that have a definite Hamiltonian, like BFSS, and there are quantum systems that have Hamiltonians that do random work, like random quantum circuit.
Which?
I'll define it.
Okay.
It's just a Wigner process. Let me just get there. So here is randomness. This is the max. This is like random walk. This is basically Hamiltonian. And this is like time independent definite Hamiltonian. So you might ask, why did we consider random Hamiltonians? It's just the first thing a quantum information theory would think of. It's just very natural in quantum information theory because they're good in mixing information. They're very good. They're very efficient.
That means there's some kind of stochastic process that's outside the quantum dynamics that's telling you what to do at each step. I'm just trying to get a picture of what this means.
These are toy models, right?
It's fine if they're a toy model.
They're simply toy models. I'm not. Yes. Ideally, what we want to do is that we want to take that Hamiltonian BFSS and show it's a lot. As scramble that log n. This is what the ideal we're going to do. We're not capable of doing that, so we're just exploring toy models.
Okay, but I'm just trying to understand what the class of toy models is. Does it mean that you're going to change the Hamiltonian at each step?
Some of them, yes, but I'm going to define how I'm going to change them.
Okay.
Let me introduce my toy models.
Great.
Presumably, you could write down a space of states, and then you could throw your dart at the space of all Hamiltonians and just pick a random one. Or random unitary, and then that would do many of the things.
Well, let me just define, I have an explicit definition of what that means.
He's not doing
it. So let me define what is. So here sits what I call Brownian quantum circuit, and I'm going to show what why it sits over there. There is something that I'm going to consider that's called, these are our example toy models I'm going to mention. These are the toy models we study. We didn't, at this level, we didn't care about the physics of it, right? It's just the Hilbert space we're considering, and we're just considering a Hamiltonian, and we're considering how it scrambles, okay? This is Ising model on a random graph.
Why do you put it low on the randomness?
Because we know the Hamiltonian.
That is random.
No, this one's not random. I said this is a randomness. This model is not random. Oh,
who is coupled to who?
This is randomness in Hamiltonian, sorry.
It's
time independent. Time independent, the Hamiltonian is independent.
But the Tarsier matrix is random.
Yes, yes. So, yes, for sure. I should have mentioned that.
So,
yes.
Physically, it's random.
Well, there are different sorts of randomness. One of them is fixed Hamiltonian, one of them is not. Okay, and then we have examples in the middle as well, but I'm not going to talk about them. These are like Feynman, Dankert, I believe, models. But we're not going to talk about these. So the idea is that this model is a fast scrambler for all the states in the Hilbert space, but it has an awful amount of randomness in the Hamiltonian. It's nowhere close to a fixed Hamiltonian. Over here, we have a fixed Hamiltonian, but we can scramble very few states. As log n, okay? All right. So this is a big picture, but I'm going to go through these in detail.
We call this super VFSS in the picture eventually?
We would love to. We would love to. Well, over here, it has to be here. It has to be here, right? So, for example, I can tell you that VFSS is not going to scramble all states as log n because it has eigenstates.
Is that the only restriction? I mean, right? Is that the only restriction, or are there other?
We don't know. We don't know anything about it. I can't say anything intelligent. There might be people who know I can't say anything intelligent about it.
Wait, so you say if you pick a random Hamiltonian, then by your definition that doesn't scramble or doesn't scramble quickly because you can diagonalize it?
No, the state of states that scrambles quickly is limited.
That's physically enough.
Well, no, it's sort of generic.
I'm not trying to physically model this at the moment. I'm making a statement about certain models we study. Okay, and this is, and actually, to be completely fair, I have to say there are things we studied that are not. This is, if I gave you the impression that this is like fixed, it's not true. There are things that lie over here or over here that have less randomness but made smaller. And yeah, this is a rough picture. Okay, I don't want to make this precise in any sense. It's a rough picture. But yeah, let me not say stuff anything more than that. Okay, so lesson three. This is actually very important. Another thing that problem we had was that in the conjecture, because by nature it was about black holes, you had, this was the form that we actually saw on the board, the scrambling time over beta was larger than some C log, right? So we had a natural unit for time. Because it was a finite temperature system, we knew how we're going to measure time, in what units we're going to measure time. But so we could make this number dimensionless, this thing dimensionless. Whereas if you start with some random state that's pure, and some system that's quantum mechanical and closed, what is this natural unit of time? So far from equilibrium, perturbation that's so far from equilibrium, what is the natural unit of time? And this is where it becomes important to say that I call this practical definition, because depending on what unit of time you pick, you might have a system that scrambles like log n. You might actually find system that scrambles like square root log n, violating the conjecture. But we consider that definition irrelevant. Well, I'm going to tell you what we know and what we don't. Okay, so there are two options that we found. One, well, define your T star, the time that it takes to scramble a system of size, I don't know, kn, k being between half and zero, divided by the time it takes to scramble one bit, one site, right? And that this guy should scale like log n. This is one way of normalizing it. This seems very natural. Another way of normalizing it is that require energy to be extensive in number of degrees of freedom. If you require such a thing, it will mean that it will fix the normalization of a Hamiltonian in terms of n. And that would imply a natural unit for our system. I'll give an explicit example for this. So this is the second definition. And we'll see in certain examples, particularly this one, Ising model and random graph, you get different answers, different scaling of n, depending on what you use.
So in this case, you need the total energy to be proportional to the size of the system?
Yeah, extensive.
But if you're considering quantum states, why should that be the case? If you take a superposition of many states, the energy doesn't necessarily scale with the number of...
I agree, but this is another choice we have. I agree. It's just the assumption.
It's a choice, but what is the idea behind this?
The idea behind it, as far as I understand, is that we wanted to the energy density per site to be finite in the limit of n going to infinity.
Because?
You want a
thermodynamic
limit.
You want something that's...
In the thermodynamic limit, I know how this system should behave.
You want something nice.
Well, I want something nice. I don't want something exotic. But this is, we do not take this too seriously, because as I said, we find square root log n behavior for it.
Okay.
In some cases, we find a matching between the two. Some cases, we don't. But I think it's not terribly unphysical assumption to make.
Just let me ask, in the paper that you motivated this, Hayden and Presco, they were really interested in the context where you had a system with sort of n minus one bits that was already thermalized, and then you would add some uncorrelated information to it. And so they had a particular idea in mind for what class of states you would study. And in that case, because things were in some sense thermalized, maybe there's a more natural definition of beta.
Yeah. So you're anticipating one of the claims I'm going to make. The claim is that in the Preskill-Hayden setup, so if you want to call it Susskind page Preskill experiment, thought experiment that posed a challenge to complementarity if black holes scrambled immediately, instantaneously. We showed that if black holes are modeled by BFSS, and if there is a UV cutoff for the system, meaning that all the states, there's a scale lambda, there exists a lambda. Well, I'm going to get to this, but such that for all psi in the Hilbert space, psi h is smaller than lambda, then we can show that complementarity is not in danger. This is what we can show. So, because in that case, we know what the set of initial states we have, what the set of initial states are, and we know what we're talking about, we can show this. But this is physically a very relevant question. Let me give an example why this is relevant, because BFSS has bosonic degrees of freedom. This bosonic degrees of freedom in no sense have a bounded Hamiltonian, right? So it does not apply strictly to BFSS. But I'm cutting off all the high UV modes to be able to use a technique in quantum information theory called Lieb-Robinson bound. One of the things we're going to try to do in the next step is that we're going to try to generalize this. We've been trying to do this for a year. We generalize this to bosonic case, such that include, to get rid of this. It's difficult.
So, since you brought up complementarity in black holes, just a quick question. Given that there are probes behind horizon physics and ADS-CFT, are those examples of things that don't scramble? So you have states that do, states that don't. Are those?
I've been confused about that as well. If you're. Let me just back up. There are things about, when you talk about ADS-CFT, there are things that I don't understand from going from this to ADS-CFT. But if you're talking about the Hilbert space, a finite dimensional Hilbert space here, I know what I'm talking about. But we haven't taken the step to clarify that thing. So we're confused about it. At least I am.
But you guys have got room for it just enough. You never really say you can scramble it.
We haven't actually seen any definite either yes or no that we're going to be able to scramble those or not. We haven't seen any indication for that. Because as you see, this is like really, there's no gravity in this. It's just some quantum system, we're evolving it, we're tracing over degrees of freedom, we see what happens. Okay. All right. So lesson four, well, this is not lesson four, this is probably comment that was asked before. I'm just going to make it precise right now. What do I mean by two states being close to each other? I mean the trace norm of this guy to be smaller than epsilon. Epsilon means some small number. What is a trace norm of a matrix? It's trace of square root x dagger x. This is the definition. Why do we choose this? Because there is a theorem. The operational definition, operational meaning of trace norm is this. This is one. If you have two states that have a trace norm that's smaller than 1 over epsilon, if you have an observer that has access to these two states and he wants to devise a measurement to tell them apart, well, any measurement will fail with the probability of 1 minus 4 epsilon or something of that sort. This is the exact statement. This is the operational definition of trace norm, and that's why we love it in quantum information theory. And it turns out to be a very difficult thing to calculate, as you can see, square root. So we use all sorts of Cauchy-Schwarz inequalities, calculate simpler things such as trace of x squared, and connect to this with Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. But that's just a technicality. At the end of the day, we get an honest-to-goodness bound for this guy. Okay, this is another comment. Questions?
Density matrix or not?
Sorry?
Phi is a density matrix.
Phi is Hermitian, it's a density matrix.
So the difference between Hermitian matrices is again Hermitian?
No, not necessarily. Yeah. It's not necessarily Hermitian. Am I wrong?
What's in with those questions?
It's a linear combination.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then it is.
So you don't need a dagger on the trace that.
No, you need the dagger. You need it. I'm sure about this statement. You don't need the dagger if the states are pure. let me not say anything that's embarrassing.
If x is a summation, isn't x dagger equal x?
Yeah, but it's more general as a norm.
I agree, but then he said we use x squared, but with no loss of generality, I would say.
Okay, let me not say anything about that. This is the definition we use. That I'm not going to information theorist. So I haven't used these. I don't have an intuition about them. I can calculate them. But. Okay, so this is the first part of all the things we learned about the precise definition of scrambling time conjecture. This is the practical definition we're going to use up to this subtlety. How we're going to normalize time, and this is a basis for how we're going to. This is how we're going to proceed. Okay, so we're just trying to understand. Okay, so we studied a few different models, but the ones that I'm going to talk about probably very briefly because this is the most important. Oh, sorry, I did not mention the third thing. So we're going to address another thing. If you have time, I don't know how many minutes.
20 minutes, yeah.
This is the most exciting thing for me personally, and this is what I'm working on right now. We find lower bounds on T star for time independent Hamiltonians that are pre-generic, up to a few physical assumptions, particularly the cutoff assumption I was talking about. But these are using Lee-Robinson bounds, which is an incredibly powerful technique, and mean field approximation things. That actually goes back to the question you were asking, what happens if you just look at one side? So we use mean field approximations to make exact statements about that. Okay, so I don't think I'm going to make it to this, but let's just discuss some of these things we learned by studying these two models. I promise that I'm going to define precisely what I mean by Brownian quantum circuit. Let's do that right now. So, Brownian quantum circuits. So Brownian quantum circuits are defined as a continuous time limit of random quantum circuits, but this is how they're defined. U t plus delta dt is e to the power of I dh of ut. What is dh? Let me go back to this graph. At any time, another thing. This is a two-body problem. Forgot this. It's a two-body problem, so we allow only two-body interactions. At any time, you pick any possible combination, and for that, you pick this Hamiltonian. The time involved in infinitesimal in time. C of n is the normalization of the Hamiltonian. I'm not going to be specific about that. If j and k are sites, j less than k, alpha j and alpha k's are just sigma. These are, let's say these are qubits, and these are the sigmas, right? Sigma alpha j, sigma alpha k could be z or I or y or x, right? Tensor alpha k, the Wigner process sitting here. So what is this? This is a Wigner process independent, which is, what does that mean? It means independent Brownian motions, independent for each of the pairs that you pick, per unit variance, per unit time. These are well-studied systems in finance. People like stochastic differential equations, and this is what it's going to give you. It's going to give you a stochastic differential equation. But this is, there's natural randomness encoded in it because we pick at each time step, we pick a random Hamiltonian in a Wigner sense. So this is how we're going to evolve. Now let me just jump to the claim. What can we show about this system? I'll try to be as precise as possible. For all initial states that are pure product states, so this is a subset I'm going to restrict myself to, we show that T star defined in this way scales like log n T star phi, and this way scales like as log n. We show like this. Of course, for this is for T star of k n or T star of 1, k between half and 0. Is this clear? This is what we prove. So for this set of states, random quantum circuit defined this way is a fast scrambler. So again, this is, I think, pretty rigorous. I have to back up a little bit. There is a little bit of numerics in there as well, but a little bit for particular things. But there are certain, for a smaller set of these guys, we can show something exact. For all of them, we do a little bit of numerics, but this is to be completely honest. I'm going to give the second one, and if people are interested, I'll talk to Lee Robinson.
You are not. You will start competing with the cookies in 5 minutes. So.
Okay.
I'll try to add them.
That is always a tough matchup.
So the second example, which is a simple example that what you were talking about, but we continue with this expander graph, is Ising model and random graphs. So graph is again the same thing. You take Ising model which eats with spinners sitting at each node, and the ones that have mutual interaction are connected with an edge. This is what the graph means. Hamiltonian is nothing but some magnetic field applied in the z direction. So if you want me to be explicit, Hamiltonian is just some C of n, sum over all ij's that are connected, edges of the graph. 1 I tensor 1 j. This is Hamiltonian. Okay? Of course, it's not going to scramble any states that are eigenstates of z, but we're going to restrict ourselves to only eigenstates of x or y. Either of them. So these are our initial states, allowed states. And we show that for these set of states, if you sit on a graph that's a random graph, how is a random graph defined? The probability of an edge to be there is P. This is the definition of random graph. And the random graph is huge. Then in the large n limit, what you get is this. Tau star defined in the first, using the first definition that I erased, in this definition, goes as log n. But surprisingly, using the second definition, it goes as square root log n. So this is a big surprise. So this was a big alarm for us to be careful with our definition and our normalization.
So by the way, when you talk about this, these definitions of using the trace norm and tracing over subsystems, does subsystems for the Ising model mean tracing over sets of sites, or does it mean arbitrary factors in the total Hilbert space?
So when I say I trace over, so let's say I'm interested in size of S3. I'm interested in any three spinner subset of the system. So pick these three, pick those three.
But the three actual nodes of the graph. It's not some other eight-dimensional.
No. It's nodes of the graph. Nodes of the graph. Okay. So lessons over here.
Is it a statement in probability over all graphs? I mean, you fix the representative, work out the time, and then take the average time, or?
Sorry, which is? What is this?
I'm trying to understand what it means to say.
This is the definition of a random graph.
Yeah, you fix a particular graph to do the evolution.
No. You fix nodes, okay? And the probability of an edge between two random nodes, ij, to exist as an edge is p.
So you're doing the statement averaged over the ensemble.
Yes, it's all average, and it's all this entire limit of angle infinity.
So why are you saying Hamiltonian is fixed? It's clear that Hamiltonian is only defined if the lengths are other lengths.
Sorry?
Yeah, but each realization, he's got a fixed Hamiltonian, then he averages over the realization.
Averaging over Hamiltonians.
So Hamiltonian isn't fixed. I've got a bunch of
this is a semantic problem.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's different from the previous one where the Hamiltonian varies from time point to time.
This is time independent, if you wish.
Obviously, there is.
If it's true in the average, it must be true for most of the cases.
Yes, but clearly you could come up with graphs where the Ising model is integrable, and then you wouldn't get some Hamiltonians. So this is clearly
This is integrable in many of these graphs, in any particular
graph. This is integrable.
Completely integrable.
This is completely integrable, yes.
In fact, the Poincaré time is twice the.
Yeah.
It's twice the Scrambling time. So it's not a very good example.
So this is not a very good example. Okay. Now that we're talking about, I can say a few things more. So this system has a Poincaré recurrence time, and what we mean by scrambling time is we'll look at the time that the state is for soft system. We'll look at the time that the state is as entangled as possible, maximally entangled. And that turns out to be half of the recurrence time, Poincaré recurrence time, which is not very meaningful. Because at the beginning, I told you that we want this time scale, scrambling time scale, to be much smaller than recurrence time. But nevertheless, it's an example we studied, and this is what we get. This is the lesson we learned. I think that was an important thing.
What happens if you put a side kinetic term, just a term that is called with sigma x, Hamiltonian, then?
I don't think we can. But look at different versions of this. As I said, we put this on an expander graph, and the naive thing that we observed was that expander graph actually does not give us fast scrambling. But again, we have already seen that fast scrambling depends on the definition.
Well, so not saying that the energy sort of disperses faster than the information? The second definition was energy spreading out or something?
Oh, no, this is just normalization of energy. Normalization of time was fixed by. Energy became extensive in number of degrees of freedom.
Yes.
So it's just a way to normalize time.
That happened faster than the top thing, which had something more to do directly with entropy.
No, we divided how long does it take to scramble a subset of size s to subset of size 1.
Where scrambling means?
Just scrambling that one side. Any site. So it means this. You start with a state, this, okay? You put an index j, and all these other states are independent of this j, okay? And at what you say, declare the system to be scrambled if any subset of size, if you look at this guy, it is forgotten about j. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you divide this by the one that has
it. Right, because it has a lot more to do with the information.
Exactly.
The
first one is more information theoretic, the second one is more physically motivated, but what is the physics of this? We don't know.
So you've considered this probability constant, which means that when n gets large, a site will be connected to sort of order one. You'll have a very large number of links, right?
Well, the number of links that are going to be dependent on p.
Right, but it's going to grow like Pn, where n is.
No, it's not going to grow like Pn.
Then I'm confused. I thought that you, for any two.
The number.
For any given site, it's going to be connected to Pn neighbors. Is that not right?
For any given site.
You pick.
Sorry, let me see.
It's not.
Oh, Pn, like Pn.
P times n, yeah.
P to the power of n. Okay, yes.
So did you consider the limit where. Actually, the sort of average number of neighbors is constant. That's sort of like a more local sort of thing.
That would be a different random graph. We didn't consider that. This is a standard random graph where theorems are proven for there are theorems to use someone's result.
But also, because your energy, you sort of assumed that the energy was growing with the number of sites, right?
One of the definitions.
In your second definition?
Yes.
But really, you have a number of terms in your Hamiltonian that's growing like n squared.
Yeah.
Does that account for this? Is that what's accounting for the square root?
As a set. Sorry?
Is that what's accounting for the square root? You sort of normalize the energy by n, but really it's growing with n squared.
If you use that argument, I don't think that argument is correct, because if you use that argument, it would apply to the other case as well. But the other case, for any quantum circuits, we got the same scaling for both.
Okay.
Right? The definitions depend, the fact that they give different scaling is a particular feature of this model. It's not a generic statement. Okay, so let me just conclude by saying a few things about these, and then I'll just skip the lower bounds if they're interested. I'm more than happy to talk about them because I find them the most exciting thing. So first thing is that fast scramblers do not have necessarily complicated dynamics. This is the most important thing. So if you're looking after a strongly coupled weird Hamiltonian, you don't have to look at that to get fast scrambling. Second thing, another thing is that adding edges does not necessarily make scrambling faster. This is very, very counterintuitive. It's a true statement. Random graph. This random graph scrambles faster than a complete graph. We're using our definition of scrambling and using the set that we restricted to. So this is another very, very tricky thing.
For either of the definitions of scrambling.
Yeah.
This is just like the result in random network theory. If you say that you have a bunch of cities connected by roads, then for an average configuration of roads, if you add a road, traffic will get slower rather than faster half of the time.
It's exactly the same thing. So, but it's counterintuitive. It's something to watch. Be careful with that. Yeah, I think I'm going to stop because I'm already over time, but there are interesting stuff about the Robinson bounds, including the theorem I mentioned, the FSS. Yeah. Thank you so much. If you have other questions.